was the other interview?
Linda
Baltimore.
Smith.
But was that Baltimore?
Well, it doesn't really matter. I get the idea.
I'm not really so scatterbrained. This is the plight of the touring author.
Mm-hmm.
You just get very punchy very fast.
Do you like it?
I like having my book out. I'm delighted that it's being well received. And this part is certainly fun to get around.
Well,
walk around the country.
William Kennedy has a phrase. He says, after he writes the book, he has to give the book its due, because he doesn't feel the publisher is going to do that much or can do that much. They try, some of them.
They try.
But
certainly
not all
mine
of them.
Does. But now my job is to help sell the book. We
mm-hmm.
bravely printed 35,000 copies, which is a great many books.
It sure is.
And my basement isn't that large.
No. Well, at least it wasn't Vantage Press that published.
True.
Well, it's a wonderful memoir. I found it very difficult to put down. It reads just like a story, and I guess a memoir that does what it's supposed to do does read like a story. Why did you decide, after writing this earlier novel that was set in Marin County, to write a memoir about your father instead of a novel in which your father may have appeared?
I considered writing a novel. I knew that I wanted to write about this material at some point. It was sort of clamoring at me to be written. And I first approached my publisher about a novel, excuse me, a novelized treatment of this material. And Bob Gottlieb, my editor at Knopf, said, no, the story is so exotic and so, in his view, compelling as fact, that it would be a mistake to turn it into fiction and turn it somehow into Paper Moon.
Mm-hmm. One thing that helped you when you wrote the memoir is that very little in your family seemed to be thrown away. Isn't that true?
This is true. It was a family of pack rats. I had volumes and volumes and volumes of letters, photographs, family memorabilia of all kinds. I've been wondering, in fact, I was discussing this with someone else earlier today, what happens now that everybody makes phone calls instead of writing those intimate letters that documented lives?
That's true. And most people, I think we can consider most Americans nuclear families, and I have a feeling they don't save too much of a personal nature. Now, they may save old comic books, Life magazines, National Geographic, things like that. But I have this feeling that we don't save too much of a personal nature. I was thinking, my mother and father are very old, and my father just had an operation last week. They live in Texas. And I was thinking about the amount of correspondence that has gone between me and them. A lot, over many, many years. But I didn't save any of it to speak of. In the last few years, I've saved some. And whenever I visit them, they don't save anything that I've sent. So I have a feeling that it's harder in many respects to put together a family history today than it might be in the past, when people did seem to save more. Or maybe this is only an imaginary in my part, but I have a feeling people were better preservationists in the past.
That's a possibility. I know my family kept those huge leather scrapbooks, and I now have, I guess, a 25-year accumulation of yellowing snapshots, unlabeled. Can't remember who some of the people are in them. I have never managed to order all that material and preserve it in some fashion so that my kids would have it at some point. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we should be less sentimental about such things. I don't know.
No, I think we should be sentimental about such things. I imagine the photographs also helped to spark in your mind the lay of the land, the appearance of the houses, how the people looked. It helped to provoke your memory, it would seem to me.
Very much so. The photos, I think, are a real compendium of portrait style dating back to the 30s, and they're eloquent photographs. They really have narrative power themselves for me.
Well, I think it's important that the listeners know exactly who Cy McFadden was.
I'm sorry, My father's name was Cy Taylor.
I'm sorry.
My married name.
Absolutely. I'm terribly sorry. That's right. He was Cy Taylor, and I'm pronouncing that correctly,
yes.
Taylor,
mm-hmm.
Was a very prominent man in the West. And why don't you tell me how he developed his prominence and what he did?
My father was a professional rodeo announcer, which here on the East Coast is terribly arcane, but rodeo, of course, is a big part not only of the West, but of America now. The circuit is all over the country and year-round. My father began announcing rodeos in the early 30s and was announcing them for right up until the last few years of his life, well into the 70s. And because he was an exceedingly flamboyant personality, a man with a very singular speaking voice. He started out in radio, and he had a very deep, resonant baritone voice. He became known as the Dean of the Rodeo Announcers, and he had almost movie star-like celebrity over most of the western states.
He and your mother had a rather explosive relationship. Tell
me
about that.
That's a good word for it. My mother also saw herself as a show business performer. She had a very, very minor career, really, as a showgirl in the Midwest, but she didn't see it as minor. And she never gave up that notion of herself as a star, in effect. She competed with my father, certainly, in just about everything. And it was a stormy, competitive, tempestuous marriage. Very intense, but ruinous in lots of ways.
What happened to it?
Alcohol, numerous assorted seductions on both sides, that competitive edge between them, just a great deal of chaos in their lives. They also eventually had a small child, and were completely unprepared to be parents in the usual sense of the word, domestic and settled and stable. They were affectionate in their own fashion, but they often forgot the laundry on the road, and occasionally they would park me with a cowboy babysitter and forget me. Not with even the slightest suggestion of brutalizing me in some fashion. They were just busy hurtling off to the next rodeo.
They went from one rodeo to another, and you were a very small child. You must remember very vividly, however, the experience of traveling on the road.
I do indeed.
Tell me about that.
Well, we essentially lived in our car, which was a 1937 Packard. I thought it was very elegant, and in fact, it was for the time. We would generally do a one-night stand in a small town, sometimes an afternoon matinee and then an evening rodeo. And very often, because my father wasn't well paid at all, there simply wasn't that much money on the circuit then, we would make enough money for gas to get to the next rodeo. And sometimes drive all night, or leave very early in the morning, cover vast distances, live on hamburgers and milkshakes, which I thought was terrific, kids' favorite diet, and turn up at the next dusty small town.
After your mother and father broke up, you went to Missoula, Montana, to live with your mother, who remarried a family friend. How much of your father did you see after this point?
I saw him fairly often immediately after the divorce and my mother's remarriage. He would come back into town and make a grand entrance. He was very good at that, and when he came to town, it was sort of I love a parade. Then, of course, he and my mother had a flaming affair after her second marriage, and he was not welcome in our household after that for all kinds of reasons. My mother returned to the marriage, and it sort of stumbled on. I would then join him on the circuit no more than a few times a year, usually. That time was very precious to me. And he did have that wonderful knack for the sentimental gift that didn't cost much money, but was the thing in the world I wanted most, or the birthday telegram, which convinced everybody in Missoula that somebody died because the kid came down the street on the bicycle to deliver this. Fathers did not send birthday telegrams at the time. He was the sort of father who would send you a single rose on some sentimental occasion, so he still loomed very large to me indeed.
What was your mother's new husband like?
Earnest, stable, kindly, certainly, as far as she was concerned. I think he loved her very dearly. He was a very dull man, rigid about his ideas. He was the sort of person who thought you should chew every bite of food 30 times. This wears thin in a big hurry. He had some interesting eccentric aspects himself. He became, for example, a health food fanist. Absolutely fanatic about it long before that was fashionable. I think he was bitterly disappointed. He married my mother, having obviously admired her from afar for a great many years. And it was obvious in fairly short order that this was not going to be the ideal marriage, or even a particularly close and affectionate one.
Now, there's another predominant character in Rain or Shine, and that is the character in the form of an aunt. Tell me about her.
She was a character in the form of an aunt. You put that nicely. She was my mother's sister, my Aunt Isla May. She was small, assertive, attractive herself, jealous of my mother, I think, and her flamboyance, but also deeply disapproving of that sort of small-time show business life of my mother's. She was really funny. She muscled her way into this book. just the way she used to muscle herself into our lives. I am amazed at the extent to which she managed to push and jab with her elbows and maneuver herself in there. But she wrote those, I thought, truly hilarious and wonderful letters that I could not resist incorporating.
Your father remarried, and you went to stay with your father and his bride on occasion, I believe, in San Francisco. Or was it Oakland? Oakland or...
Great Falls, Montana was their home base, but yes, I went to Oakland, California with them when my father was in the Army there.
Well, tell me about her, and what was your relationship like with her?
She was, when I was a child, Dorothy was the wicked stepmother in my eyes. She was extremely jealous of my mother. She did not particularly enjoy having me around, with excellent reason. I was a royal pain in the neck. I can look back on myself now and realize that if I wasn't deeply drawn to her, she must have thought I was peculiar in the extreme, with good reason. She made my father enormously happy over a very, very long marriage. She was the classic good woman behind the man, loyal, absolutely loving, self-effacing, very much my father's press agent, and unlike my mother, she never bumped him out of the spotlight. She was certainly the right person for him.
Meanwhile, your mother was showing signs of mental illness, wasn't she?
More than signs. She was having repeated nervous breakdowns.
What kind of impact did this have on you and the family?
It was mystifying to me as a kid, in particular because nobody really explained to me what was going on. I think children were shielded from a lot of information then about what was happening in their families. It was obviously... hard on the household. My stepfather was anguished and concerned, and nobody quite knew how to treat mental illness, or at least to treat my mother's form of depression then. And then she would come back and rally to one extent or another. I have mixed memories of her, but one was that even with all that pain and depression in her own life, she could still be an absolute spitfire. The old sparky chorus girl would surface from time to time, and then look out.
As you moved into adulthood, what sort of relationship developed between you and your father?
My father and I were progressively more estranged from one another when I was growing up. He was becoming more conservative all the time, politically conservative, was seeing himself, the creature of his press clippings, as the Western statesman. And I was extremely skeptical of about that. I'd known my father for a very long time. I was not as impressed as the rest of the world. My own politics, quite predictably, were going in the other direction. I was in flaming reaction against that, in my view, hidebound conservative side of my father. And we just argued about absolutely everything. We could have dinner in a Chinese restaurant and argue bitterly about what to eat on the menu.
How did you make peace with your father, if indeed you ever did?
I made peace with my father at long distance when, rather near the end of his life, He knew that he had cancer. He had, at that point, we had been really estranged for almost 8 years. We kept in touch through the relatives. Do you ever hear from what's his name or what's her name? Very painful time for us both. And my father wrote me, and he wrote me what I still think is a classic letter, and again, a very funny one. He wrote that he was making the first move to mend the broken fences because he was incapable of holding a grudge. And this was after 8 years. And that wonderful arrogance of his just infuriated me. And I also thought, some years older myself, that it was very, very funny indeed and somehow sympathetic.
Now, he died in 1980, isn't that true? Was it 80?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And when did you publish your first book?
I published my first book at the end of, I believe, the end of 77.
And what was his reaction to it?
He was enormously proud. He was a writer of sorts himself. He did a lot of writing for Western periodicals and magazines, and he had a great many fans. He wrote, in my view, extremely sentimental but very literate articles about horses named Old Ned and wild birds that ate out of his hand. I don't know what in the world he made of my satire about suburban California life. He didn't think it looked like a book. It had a very peculiar packaging with a ring binding and a kind of cartoonish cover. And that absolutely bewildered my father. He couldn't imagine why this thing was regarded as a book. But he clipped my press clippings. He wrote me one writer to the other sorts of letters. He began mentioning me in interviews, and for years he'd said he had two children rather than three. And all of a sudden he was doing a wonderful sort of my daughter the writer turnaround about that.
After you began, or as you began work on Rain or Shine, what was it like writing so intimately about your mother and your father? Could you, as a writer, divorce yourself from your own emotions toward them?
I tried at first. I was trying to write a much more distanced and impersonal sort of book, and of course I couldn't do that. I just kept being pulled into it very strongly. I've still tried terribly hard to keep this book my parents' story and not my own, as they're the people who are interesting and singular. As for how it was writing, and it was just terribly hard. I'm a slow, laborious writer anyway. Now that I'm on a newspaper, I'm the last rock carver in the newsroom.
The last what?
I am the rock carver. I am the person who sort of chisels one word out of a time out of a word processor while everybody else has written 1,000, 1,500 superbly literate words of reporting.
There is one, you say you try to keep yourself out of it, but there is the one chapter where you and I believe your brother, Tom, was it Tom?
I think you must be talking rodeo. About the Mile City. That's my older brother, Terry.
Terry, close I'm enough. Sorry. I forget the name sometimes, but at any rate, you go to the rodeo, following mm-hmm. in the footsteps of your father. But that was, I think, the one departure from the area and covering your mother and father's relationship and the other people. So
that trip was a resolution of my tangled, complicated family relationships for me in all kinds of ways, and I think the chapter probably serves that purpose. Mm-hmm. It's terribly affectionate, I think, this book, because I really have enormously strong, affectionate ties to that country and to my own rather odd legacy.
What's it like, because you've lived in San Francisco for quite a while, but what's it like living in San Francisco as opposed to the Middle West?
Oh, I dearly love it. I'm the classic small-town girl who could not wait to get to the Great White Way. And as I've said to other people, I thought it was Spokane, Washington. Gradually managed to migrate farther south. But I am now a city dweller, right down to the bone. I really love it. Love to go home.
You live in the city?
I live right in San Francisco.
And you walk the hills up and down?
Of course.
Oh, well, you must have a lot of stamina. you are doing a newspaper column now.
I'm doing a newspaper column for the San Francisco Examiner, which is the evening paper there. It's also the Hearst paper, and Will Hearst, the family scion, has taken over as a very, very bright, energetic young publisher. And the paper is sort of ticking off in all directions. It's much more energetic. Its news coverage is getting better all the time. And it's done some rather innovative and perhaps peculiar things as such as hiring me and Hunter S. Thompson, who's another columnist for The Examiner.
What kind of column do you do?
Well, I call it a specific interest column as opposed to a general interest column because it's whatever I'm interested in on a given day. I have written about, I've written a great many humor columns, I suppose you'd call them. And I've also written about serious subjects that are of interest to me.
These are in the form of essays,
mm-hmm.
a specific topic for each, opposed to the type of column Herb Kane produces, which is a whole bunch of little bits and pieces.
He writes an item column, and of course he's also the grand master of newspaper columnists. Nice to be mentioned in the same sentence, but mine doesn't resemble his.
I was reading a very interesting article about him in the Washington Journalism Review. I had no idea that he had that much impact in San Francisco.
Oh, my word. For every 750 words of mine addressing some civic problem, all Herb has to do is sneeze almost inaudibly, and the machinery starts turning to redress whatever it is.
Well, he's been doing it for many, many years. Well, when can we expect some more fiction from you?
Coming up. I'm not quite sure when. I have notes and an idea for another novel, which will certainly be a comic novel. I wanted to write this book, and I'm deeply pleased to have it in print, and it's being, so far, looking for wood to knock on. It's being...
You won't find it here.
Well, I won't find it here. I don't think you can knock on Formica. It's being well received. And I'm really pleased about that. And now I want to take on a comic novel again, because after this book, it's going to be duck soup.
You have a nice little, or not little, I guess, a substantial literary colony in San Francisco, don't you?
Indeed, we do.
I've interviewed people like Herb Gold.
Who's a good friend.
Alice Adams and Anne Rice.
Yes.
And several others whose names escape me. But there seems to... Do you all get together? Is there some sort of literary establishment where you all hang out? Or do you go to each other's houses? Or what happens?
There is not a literary establishment as such. We don't have any lanes, for example. But it is an extremely warm... nobody in Manhattan is going to believe me as I say this. It's a very warm, supportive, non-competitive literary community there. It's terrific. When I was the new kid on the block, admittedly the world's oldest new kid, but there I was several years ago with Serial, that group of writers took me in very, very warmly, and they have become, over the years, best and closest friends.
You have a lot of bookstores, too. I guess the most prominent that I know of is City Lights, huh?
City Lights is a wonderful old institution.
Well, Syra McFadden, it's a wonderful memoir that you've written, Rain or Shine, and I know the readers are going to enjoy it. I certainly did, and I appreciate the fact that you took the time to come in and talk to me, because I know you must be dragging, but I'm glad you forced yourself to do it anyway.
Me.
Thank you very much.